Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 15th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. Each year, Tulsa's Council for Holocaust Education is focused on a different facet of the Holocaust story. In past years, it has focused on defiance and resistance, reconciliation between perpetrators and victims, the Jewish diaspora after the war, or the story of liberators. This year, the Council examines the motivation and heroism of the Righteous Among the Nations, Israel's official title for non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust. My guest today is one of the leading authorities on rescue during the Holocaust, Dr. Mordechai Paldiel, the former director of the Department of the Righteous at Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Authority. He's currently a lecturer at Yeshiva College and Queens College. He was born in Belgium, and Dr. Paldiel and his family of six were aided by the Righteous Among the Nations. Their family fled to France during the war, where they were rescued by a Catholic priest who was able to smuggle the entire family into Switzerland. He's the author of a number of books on rescue during the Holocaust, including The Path of the Righteous, Whosoever Saves One Life, Sheltering the Jews, Stories of Holocaust Rescuers, and German Rescuers of Jews, Individuals Versus the System. He'll be the speaker tomorrow night at Temple Israel for the Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. He joins us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Paldiel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about the Righteous. The Righteous has a specific thought and terminology behind that term when it comes to Jewish scholarship. What do we mean by the Righteous?
Well, when we say righteous, or when we say the full term of that program is Righteous Among the Nations, it's a translation from the Hebrew term Chasidei Umot Ha'olam, which is a term which was coined by the rabbi back 2,000 years ago during the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud to indicate non-Jews who, according to the rabbis, have also a place in paradise in the world to come if they observe certain minimal moral requirements, which come under the heading of the seven precepts of the children of Noah. So the rabbi said that although non-Jews are not obligated to follow the strictures of Moses, the laws of the Torah, since they're not Jews, but they too have an equal standing up there when they get up there, as well as Jews, if they observe certain minimal standards of justice and morality. So it was a term coined by the rabbis, and it has also a popular explanation over the centuries. It's about non-Jews who showed affection and helped out Jews during the periods of crisis for Jews. But anyway, when Yad Vashem was created in 1953, in the statute of Yad Vashem, which was created by law, it stated that one of the goals of Yad Vashem is to seek out the righteous among the nations who risked their lives to save Jews from destruction. So Yad Vashem gave a new interpretation to the term righteous among the nations, in that it specified that as far as Yad Vashem was concerned, a righteous person, a non-Jewish righteous person, is one who risked his or her life to save Jews from the Nazis, from destruction. So that's a new interpretation. When we say righteous, we don't mean that these persons were necessarily saints throughout all the facets of their lives. We don't seek out persons like Francis of Assisi or Mother Teresa. We simply seek out persons who acted to save Jews, and they did that when they were fully aware that they could pay a heavy price for that if discovered. They could pay with their own life. And that is we are satisfied in establishing that part of that person's life during the Holocaust. And if so, then we attribute on her, the title of Righteous Among the Nations.
You know, the way you describe it, it sounds like the reinterpretation of this righteous in the wake of the Holocaust is a much higher standard.
It is a much higher standard, yeah. Because in the old interpretation, there's no risk involved there in the old rabbinic view of where the righteous is, righteous Gentile. But in the Yad Vashem interpretation, it's a person, because the Nazis, they made it known that anyone who would help Jews to avoid arrest and confinement, that person would suffer the same fate as the Jews. And so it was a very risky undertaking. And indeed, at the Yad Vashem, under this program, we have not a few names of people who did pay the ultimate price when it was discovered due to denouncement or betrayal and so forth. And they wound up either being put up against the wall, or they went to imprisonment or to concentration camps, and some of them did not return from there. So, but the interesting thing and the significant thing is that contrary to what some sociologists and psychologists tell us about human behavior, that people are mainly concerned with their own welfare and are not prepared to risk their life, are not prepared to do a good deed when it involves losing one's life. Well, here there were thousands and thousands of persons from all walks of life, literate and illiterate, from all kinds of positions, who for certain mysterious reasons were prepared to risk their life to save Jews, although they were not required to do so. These are not persons that they knew personally. These are not members of their families. These are strangers or people they might have been slightly acquainted with, but they decided to save them because they felt that these people had a right to live. And they were prepared to take all the risks involved. Of course, they took precautions, great precautions, that their sheltering of Jews, in those cases where people had Jews in their homes, would not be discovered. And so we think that this should be pointed out. These people should be acknowledged. They should be honored. Their stories should be told to show the goodness of these people at a time when goodness was in very short supply.
You mentioned the psychological and sociological background. You know, I think this was one of the interesting things about it is many of these righteous led morally ambiguous lives as far as everyday life. But when it came to this big life and death, are you going to be for human, you know, human rights, human life? They stepped up and said, that is wrong. This is the right path.
Yeah, that's right. Let's take the case of Oskar Schindler. Very ambiguous moral life. Very ambiguous. I don't want to speak out against him. But anyone involved with Oskar Schindler in his private life, his womanizing, his drinking, and his also his financing. You know, he started out his career as a spy for the Germans. He spied for the Germans when he was in Czechoslovakia. And he came to Poland. In fact, when he came to Poland in the wake of the German occupation of Poland, which launched World War II, he came to Poland as a carpetbagger. He wanted to as a profiteer on cheap labor, cheap Jewish labor. So he started on the left foot. But while he was there, it was a transformation because he realized that these people who were working for him and making it possible for him to live the good life, the life of a playboy, and these people now were threatened with death, and he felt this is unacceptable, and that he was going to do everything in his power and use all the unorthodox methods that he was acquainted with and he was schooled into and spend all the money that he had accumulated on the black market. He was going to do all this to save these people. But these people had a right to live, and he did save 1,200 people. At the end of the war, it had cost him so much money that he didn't have anything left. He was out of money, and he had to be supported by those that he had helped to survive. Mm-hmm. So here you have a transformation taking place during the war years of a man who, at the beginning, was not concerned with the welfare of others, was only concerned with himself, and it turned out to be one of the largest rescuers of Jews, right under the nose of the Nazis. And this went on for an extended period, for like 3 years, from 42 to 45. So it shows that these people, like you mentioned, they have a very ambiguous private life, but yet they did the most saintly act one could do during a certain period of their life, during one of the most critical phases of a person's life. And the question that they asked themselves: have these persons who work for me and make possible for me to lead such a good life, do they have a right to live? Or should I simply overlook the fact that my own people are trying to destroy them for no obvious reason, simply because they were born? And if so, then I'm going to do something. I'm going to do everything in order to subvert that. So that's the story of the righteous among the nations. Yeah. They did get involved. They didn't stand by. They were not bystanders. They did get involved because they felt that no one has a right to decide on who is to live and who is to die, except God himself.
For every Oscar Schindler and Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat, there are probably hundreds of times of names unknown or little known. Well, your own story, one of the reasons you're so involved in this, I would think, is because you were rescued as a child.
Yeah, I was also, as a child, I was born in Belgium, and when the war came to Belgium, we fled to France. And we wandered, that's me and my family, I was a little child, I was born in 1937. So we wandered from place to place, from the occupied zone to the non-occupied zone, and then to the Italian zones. The Italian had a small zone in France, and they were not, they were good to the Jews, the Italians. And then when the Italians capitulated and Germans took over, someone referred my mother to a priest, a Catholic priest, who was living not far from the Swiss border in a city called Evian. And she went over to him secretly, and he decided he was going to help us to cross into Switzerland, of course, to cross the border illegally. And he organized a team of two people that led us at night across the border into Switzerland. And, of course, the Swiss arrested us, but they let us in because their policy then had changed and they allowed us into Switzerland. And so we were safe and sound in Switzerland, although we were confined to certain places, but of course we were safe as far as our lives are concerned. But then when I came to work at Yad Vashem, I quizzed my parents about this man, and they gave me all kinds of details. They didn't remember his name, his exact name, because they didn't in wartime people didn't go by their true name. They went by code names for security reasons. And but I was helped by a group of people in France to identify the person, and my mother then identified him and a picture of him, and several stories, that the story of how he became involved in our rescue. And we found him. He was he had retired from the priesthood. He was in his 80s. He was in a Catholic home, but we found him, and we went over. We had a nice ceremony in 1990. And we declared him as a righteous among the nations. We had a big ceremony in France, and I went there personally to thank him, shake his hand. I have some photos of me and him. And he had a tree at Yad Vashem. Mm-hmm. He has since passed away, and I'm glad that I did my share in acknowledging the goodness of this person.
How difficult has it been to find the righteous after the war, if they're using code names, if... You know, I can just imagine the fear and trepidation of those who are being rescued could blur names, faces.
What I'm saying, code names, is when someone refers you to someone, and that person's name, for instance, is Joseph. Now he wouldn't say go over to Joseph. He would say go over to Joe, or go over to. To J.O. or J.R., whatever. But then these persons, later on, when they became more, they got to know the other person because they stayed with him for some time, then they, of course, they knew the full name. In my case, my parents never found out the full name of this person because it was a meeting which lasted a few minutes, and then maybe they met again for several times. And then that priest, he told us to stay in a certain home and that there would be two men that would come and they would arrange and they would take us over the border. So we never really got to know that person, that priest, who made all the arrangements,
yeah.
You see? But in other cases, like Oskar Schindler, of course, he had a factory. The people worked for him. They knew his real name. I mean, there was no mystery. In most cases of the righteous, people know their rescuers. Because in many of these stories, they were hidden in their own homes. We're talking about people who were hiding in the homes of the rescuers. They were hiding either in the basement, in the attic, or in some place in the barn. And so they knew exactly the names of their rescuers. There was no problem of identification in most cases.
My guest today is Dr. Mordechai Paldiel. He's the former director of the Righteous at Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Authority. He's currently a professor at Yeshiva University. He'll be giving the 2012 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration Lecture, which takes place this Thursday at Temple Israel. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. This year's theme is Why Memory Matters, Israel's Yad Vashem. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, the idea of hiding someone in the home, in the abstract, it sounds like, well, you know, put them in the attic, put them in the basement, you know, we have to feed them, clothe them. It sounds, you know, when you actually think of what was entailed, it becomes, I mean, this was a tremendous risk.
Absolutely.
And I think I've read some of your accounts where it's like, you know, they cannot come out of that basement or out of that attic ever. Bodily waste,
That's
refuse.
Right. Everything has to be carefully thought out, meticulously planned. First of all, if you have children, then you have to keep, especially if you have children, toddlers. In some stories, the toddlers in the home, they didn't know that under the floor, the ground floor of the home in the basement, someplace there were people hiding. They didn't know it because the toddlers, the little children, could not be trusted that it wouldn't divulge the story to outsiders. The other thing is that when you're hiding people that are being searched by the police, you can't have too many visitors. You got to plan. You got to make plans when people want to drop over and visit. And they knock on the door. You got to make sure that these people downstairs in the basement they keep absolutely quiet. The other thing is that you have to feed these people, so you got to buy additional food. Now, how are you going to buy additional food in a period of rationing of food without being noticed? You go to the local grocery and you buy food for more people. The grocer would ask you, "How come you're buying twice as much or three times as much food than previously?" So what you have to do, you have to visit several groceries and not just one. So everything has to be planned because the slightest mistake could be fatal. Could be fatal for the rescuer and fatal for the people that you are hiding. So it's a very dangerous and risky thing, and this could last for not for weeks but for months. In some cases, for 2 years and 2.5 years.
And the reprisals for the righteous, if they were caught, did it vary? I mean, I would think in Poland, they would be shot. Maybe in Western Europe, not so much, or was it pretty severe everywhere?
It was pretty severe. Well, in Poland, they could be shot, yeah, because they were warning posters in Polish and German on the major street intersections saying that anyone helping a Jew and so on, the death penalty would be applied. There's no appeal to that. And so the population was warned, and so that was in Poland, in Lithuania, Ukraine, in Eastern Europe. In Western Europe, the people who were helping Jews, now, it all depends. If a person was caught with one or two Jews in his home, well, maybe that person went to prison or paid a fine. It all depends on the local judge and local German commander. But if that person, it was discovered that he was involved in helping many Jews, and like he was, it's like a clandestine operation, that person would wound up in a concentration camp. So it was risky all over. Helping a Jew was a capital offense.
I was surprised looking at the Jewish Foundation for the Righteous, which I guess helps many of the righteous in their old age. I was surprised to see there were actually German army officers on the list.
Yes, German army officers of the regular army, the Wehrmacht.
Right.
Some of them helped Jews. That's right.
That's somewhat surprising to me, but it's interesting that the hunt for the righteous goes wherever people did help Jews during this horrible, horrific time.
Oh, yes. There were people in the German army who regular Germans who were drafted in the army, as everyone else in Germany during the war, and who disagreed with their government's policy regarding the Jews. Not every German was a diehard, will-in-the-eye Nazi. not every German. The problem was there were too many Germans that did follow Hitler. That's the problem. You can't discount a population of over 65 million that they were. You know, the Communist Party was very powerful in Germany on the eve of Hitler's rise. The Socialist Party was a... That's the way many people disagreed with Hitler. With Hitler's policies in general and with his policies with regard to the Jews. Some people may have had some stereotyped opinions about Jews. maybe the Jews were not behaving correctly, and maybe they were occupying too many important posts. But from here to expelling Jews and sending them to concentration camps, so many people were repelled by this. I say many. I'm not a statistician, but there were some people, and later on these people who appeared in uniform of the military, when they had a chance to help out a few Jews, then they did that. So they are included on the list of the righteous, sure.
We talked about Oskar Schindler, Raoul Wallenberg, who offered these exit visas, if you will, in Budapest during the war. These are names that are very familiar to us, but many of these names are unknown. Can you tell us the story of one person we ought to know the name of from this period among the righteous?
Oh, there you've got me, because I have dealt with thousands of names, and I've written about them. I want to tell you the story of an Italian. His name was Lorenzo Perone, and he was an illiterate person who worked in construction. And he was working for a company, for the construction company in Italian. And one day the Italian company was received a contract to go to Auschwitz for some kind of construction project to add a certain building. And he went there. You know, the Italians and the Germans were allies during the war. And one of the Jewish prisoners in Auschwitz was assigned to help out with loading the cement. And that Italian was Primo Levi. Primo Levi, who later on wrote about the Holocaust,
yes,
many books. And that Lorenzo decided he was going to help Primo Levi stay alive. He was going to steal food from the kitchen of the Italian workers. And he would leave it in a certain spot, and Primo Levi would pick up the food, and then he would go back to his barracks and distribute it among his friends. Friends asked him, where did you get that additional food in Auschwitz? And he wouldn't disclose that. And this went on for some time. And then Primo Levi told this Lorenzo, you know, I have people back in Italy. They don't know where I am. They probably think I'm dead. So I need to tell them in coded words to write to them. But I can't write because Jewish people were not allowed to write in Auschwitz. But you, the Italian civilian worker, and you are stationed right next to Auschwitz, you can write back home. So I'm going to tell you what to write in coded language of certain people. They'll understand that this is me writing to them. So Lorenzo wrote letters from Auschwitz to these people, and in return for that, Lorenzo received packages of chocolate and cocoa and sugar and candy, which he then turned over to Primo Levi, and Primo Levi turned it over to his people in the barracks. Imagine getting chocolate in Auschwitz.
Wow.
And so thanks to this plain Italian worker and many of his fellows in that compound, in that Auschwitz camp, survived the war because they received the additional food. So that's a beautiful story, and Lorenzo Perone was honored by Yad Vashem. In fact, after the war, Primo Levi named two of his children after Lorenzo.
Hmm.
And to think about Lorenzo Perone, after the war, he was a failure in everything. He was a heavy drinker, and he died from an overdose of drinking. He was a plain person. But Primo Levi, who had some very harsh words to say about human behavior in general, and human behavior in the camps, and then he wrote in his book, If This Is a Man, and there he writes about Lorenzo, what Lorenzo meant to him, the impact of this plain, uneducated person on the very much educated Primo Levi. Primo Levi was a chemist by profession. And this is what he had to say. If you don't mind, I would like to read just this passage. I believe that it was really due to Lorenzo that I'm alive today, and not so much for his material aid as for his having constantly reminded me by his presence, by his natural and plain manner of being good, that there still existed a just world outside our own, something and someone still pure and whole, not corrupt, not savage. Thanks to Lorenzo, I managed not to forget that I myself was a man. A very powerful statement.
Yeah.
But when we talk about the righteous Gentile, World War II, these are not people who committed themselves. They didn't make any conscious decision. It was something like almost something that happened to them while they were on their way to their daily occupations. they ran into a Jew, or a Jew came over to them, or somebody came over to them and said, can you help? And they had to make an instantaneous decision. This is not something like, come back next week and I'll tell you what my response is. This is something like, yes, of course, I can help. Let's figure it out. Come into my house and we'll work out a plan. And suddenly that person becomes a rescuer of that person and that person's family. And he's preparing a place in the attic and someplace in the basement or under the, or he's helping the person with trying to provide him with false IDs so that person can circulate under a new and false name, so on. Suddenly they got themselves involved in something they never thought of before. And they did wonders, and they saved lives.
Yes, they did.
They saved lives from destruction. And then, at the end of the war, they went back to their pride, to their own lives. They didn't seek any honors. They didn't seek any recognition. And they just went back. And if these stories had not come out from the mouth of those that were saved, we would never have known of these people. And perhaps there are many more such people that helped out, and we don't know who they are because the beneficiaries of that aid, they have since passed on. And they took the stories with them to their grave. They didn't want to talk about that period. So we don't know. So this is something that I think it has great importance for educational purposes, to show that people, plain people, can rise above themselves. You don't have to be a Mother Teresa. You don't have to be a Francis of Assisi. You don't have to be a saint. You can be whatever you are and rise above yourself under certain situations and do a Francis of Assisi act and do a Mother of Teresa act without being a Mother of Teresa.
Yeah. Well, we'll hear more at the Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. Dr. Paul Diehl, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay. Have a lovely day.
Dr. Mordecai Paul Diehl, a leading authority on rescue during the Holocaust, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the former director of the Righteous at Yad Vashem and currently a professor at Yeshiva University and Queens College. He'll be giving the 2012 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration tomorrow evening at 7 at Temple Israel. The commemoration is open to all who wish to remember. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. The University of Tulsa Departments of Film and Creative Writing will once again offer summer residential camps in screenwriting and filmmaking for high school students, from entering freshmen to graduating seniors. The camps will be held during the second and third weeks of July. Each camp is a full week of classwork, film viewing, and associated activities with top professionals. Students live on campus with 24-hour supervision. Information and application forms available at 918-631-3174.